It's time for the Board Game Barbecue Podcast. Sit back, relax, find your favourite camping chair and join us around the fire. From wherever you're listening around the world, welcome to Australia's favourite board gaming podcast. The Board Game Barbecue, brought to you by Addicts, not Experts. Hello there and welcome to the Board Game Barbecue, episode 152. And we have some fantastic folks with some fantastic stories about their board games. We got, first of all, Def. How you doing, buddy?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Had a great day of gaming today, playing a few games with my 11-year-old, which has been lovely.
Awesome.
Yeah. Joining Def and I is Mythological Mike. How are you doing?
Mythological Mike. I like that one. I'm doing good, Steve. I reckon I've done like 24 hours of gaming over this weekend.
Wow. And
I'm feeling so good. relief.
The shackles have been broken and...
I feel like I've scratched an itch that's just been growing for 6 months, and it just, oh man, if I didn't have to, I wouldn't stop. I just keep on going. So good.
Wow. Well, hopefully we'll hear about some of that in the Sizzling Games, which will be coming up next. If you've not listened to our show before, we've got our segment called Sizzling Games. We'll talk about a game that we've been playing lately that we really enjoy, followed by a topic of the pod. Today we're talking about board gaming flashbacks, which is going to be good fun. We do our bracket battle, and then we're going to finish off with swearing an oath. So why don't we just kick it off with Mythological Mike? Maybe you've got a few sizzles for us today. Who knows? What's been hitting the table?
I'll try to keep it to one, and it's one that I've been wanting to sizzle for a while because I played this game a while back, and I got a copy, and over this weekend I got to play it a few times, and oh my God, it's fun. So the game is Flick of Faith. I finally want to talk about Flick of Faith. It's just such a fun party game that I think everyone needs to try. It's just such a good laugh. It plays in about 20 minutes, and it's a dexterity area control game. So it's just an interesting mix straight away. You're playing, you're playing board gods. You just want to have fun with your prophets and just, you know, mess with each other a little bit and try to dominate four islands. So the first thing first, this game just looks absolutely stunning. It comes with, so it's a party game with a neoprene mat, which is always good. So the neoprene mat is like a beautiful bright blue with four islands on it. And basically what you're doing, you're flicking your prophets for the most part in order turn. And you generally start the game with five prophets. Each one of you is playing a god. The game comes with four cards, and each card is double-sided. And each different god has a different power. One of my favorite ones comes with this little love heart. And basically, if you can drop the love heart on top of your prophet and touch another prophet from 2 centimeters up or higher, you get to count their prophets as your area control. So you can try to, like, take over their people and... get influence on the islands. And so everyone's got these little unique player powers, which are really, really fun. And once you start flicking, at the start of each round, you actually have to choose a new rule to be incorporated into the game. Some rules are permanent that stay for the rest of the game, or some rules just for that round each. So you actually take out two rules, and everyone has to vote with a thumbs up or thumbs down which rule gets implemented. And it's just really silly. So like, when we played on the weekend, I think we had one rule, they had to flick two prophets with each hand at the same time, or stack one on top of the other and flick them both at once. Or I've had ones that you have to flick like your non-dominant hand or with your eyes closed or all sorts of crazy things. Like there's a bunch of different ones. You even have things like there's a big ape token and a big ape like a disc that you can put on the board. And if you can flick the ape with one of your prophets and push him onto another island, the island can't score anymore. So you can just mess with people and all sorts of crazy things. So once you get into the game, you do four rounds and the game's over. Basically, you want to have a profit on at least each island because you get a point for each island that you're present on, and you get 2 points per island that you dominate on. But there's little things like you have some circles on the islands, and if you can get your prophet to touch the circle or land in the circle, you can put a temple on the island permanently for the rest of the game. And a temple is about 10 times the size of one of your prophets. This big block that just sits in the middle of the island, and you can place it anywhere you like. And just because I taught the game, everyone decided to put all the temples on my island. So I literally had like four temples blocking my ability. But the cool thing is, On the edge of the board are these clouds that cover the corners, and your clouds are where you're allowed to flick from. So you actually have this little area that sort of keeps you in a certain area, but lets you sort of travel along the whole edge of the board to flick off. So it's really cool. You can go on different angles and try to do different things. You can flick each other pieces off the actual board altogether. It's just a really, really fun game. It, like I said, it plays in 20 minutes. So you can have a few games, one after another, try a different god. It does play four people max. There is an expansion coming soon. So the expansion, I believe, is on its way. It'll add a fifth player and some extra god powers and extra cards and things like that and rules you can add to the game. So I'm really looking forward to turning it into a five-player game. I don't know how they fit a fifth player on the board. I don't know if they just flick off. I have no idea. I haven't actually done a lot of research yet, but I'm keen. It's such a fun game. It's an odd-shaped box, very, very long, because you have to fit the neoprene mat in there as well. But look, it's actually made by Awakened Realms, but they're a smaller company that make the smaller games. Well, do you remember what it's called, Def? Awakened Realms Light. But it's just, it's an absolute blast. Like, I'll be bringing this with me if I'm going to a game day, I'm quite sure, because it's a great warm-up game. Gets everyone laughing and having a good time before you get stuck into some bigger games. So that's Flick of Faith. I really recommend you try it. It is actually, I don't think it's been sold from Australia before, but I do have word that there's a company about to start distributing it. So keep your eyes out. It will start hitting stores very, very soon, hopefully with the expansion.
Yeah, I remember seeing it on Kickstarter. It was actually the first time I had heard about Awakened Realms Light and the stuff that they do. And it seems like they have a whole, you know, series of games planned of these kinds of things, like very light, easy, but well, you know, with great art. And this game is absolutely gorgeous. If you've look up photos and stuff, it's very pretty. So, yeah, I remember, you know, they even for a game that light, it still looked very inviting to back it and get it and play it. And they have a new game out now, which I thought you might enjoy, Mike, that's coming up called Platformer.
Ooh, you've got my attention.
Yeah.
I'll have a look, definitely. Definitely be having a look out for Platformer because after this game with the production quality, like I said, for such a quick party game, getting a neoprene mat and your really nice different size blocks and stickers that go on there make it look awesome, I'm impressed. I'm really, really impressed. And look, it is a party game that I think will be around the $60-odd mark somewhere. But when you're looking at neoprene and the big discs and the really nice cards, I can definitely see it being worth it. Definitely. I just wish it fit in my game bag a bit easier. It's that awkward size. It's a bit too long to fit sideways along with the other games. So
yeah.
I'll be taking my game bag and this on the side. So, but no, it's an amazing game and I can't wait to play with the rest of you guys.
Awesome.
Well, I might stay on the good games to start a game day theme because I played a game. I went to a game day on the weekend and I got to play a game called Las Vegas, which has been around for nearly 10 years now, a Rüdiger Dorn game. And it's just simple dice roll and fun. So for those who aren't aware what Las Vegas is, you essentially put out these six casinos and they match a die value. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And you get a handful of 8 dice of one color. So that's your color. You roll the dice and you can then assign one value of dice to one of the casinos. So if you rolled 3 fours, you can put all 3 fours on the 4 casino. Or if you rolled that, but you don't want to go on the 4 casino, you might have 1-1 and you'll put just 1 dice on the 1, but you can only allocate to one area each round. And then the next person rolls and they allocate, the next person rolls, they allocate, so on and so forth. And all you're trying to do is get the majority in these different casinos, because underneath that is a banknote that has a certain amount of money on it. And if you win that, you take the top banknote. And it has to be a minimum of $50,000. If it's under that, so let's say we draw it out and the first one comes out as a $10,000, you've got to keep drawing until the total accumulated value is over 50. And all that means is, let's say you drew a $10,000, then a $40,000. That would mean, that the winner would take the highest value and the second place would take the second highest value. So essentially, you just roll your dice, allocate them, and then at the end of the round when everyone's dice is out, whoever has the majority takes the money that they've earned from each of the spaces. And you just do that over 4 rounds and whoever has the most money wins. So it's really simple. But where the little wrinkle in the game comes is the tiebreaker, which is just very cool. And it leads to situations where you want to
deliberately not necessarily help yourself, but more so just put yourself in the fight somewhere else. So let's say the three of us are playing and the two of you have three dice in the five and I've got one. In a tiebreak, the two top guns knock each other out and the lower takes the entire pot of money.
Oh.
So you got a situation where you're working towards something. You're like, okay, well, I'm not really in anywhere else. But you look over and go, ooh, there's a tie over there. I might just throw a die over there and then hopefully nothing else happens there and I'll get to clean up.
Okay.
There's a lot of dice roll anticipation here. Like, all right, come on, I just need a three, you know, that sort of thing. Or at one point I had four dice left and I only allocated one, but I could have allocated a couple more. But I'm like, no, I want to have more dice to play with. And then I rolled on my next roll, I rolled three ones. So I had to allocate them all because you have to. So I was like, ah, damn it. So I was out. But so it plays really quick, four rounds, just a bit of fun. Simple game. It just seems like a perfect start to a game day kind of game. So nothing super heavy, nothing to really think about here. If you look at the box, you might think, oh, this is going to be a real deep, heavy Las Vegas style game. Absolutely not. It's like you're playing craps at the table. You're just rolling those dice and hoping for your number to come up. So, yeah, Las Vegas. I think there's the original one was called Las Vegas, but on the title it was just box. It just said Vegas. And there was Las Vegas, the card game, which to me looks like the identical version of the same game. Like, I don't know what the card game means. You're still rolling dice and allocating them. And then there's Las Vegas Royale, which was released a couple of years ago, which is like a fancy version. And while that's great and all, you don't need a fancy version for this game. You just need, like, realistically, you could make this yourself. You could play with banknotes from any kind of game, add a couple of zeros on the Monopoly money, and you could do it yourself. But of course, I'd rather have the nice box on my shelf. So, yeah, check it out, Las Vegas. Super. I say check it out, but it is apparently quite hard to get a hold of. So,
okay.
I apologize in advance for that. But yeah. Definitely worth having a look if it comes up on a board game marketplace or something like that.
Sounds like a nice quick startup as well. It sounds like it wouldn't take too long at all.
Yeah, well, four rounds probably took 20 minutes, 25 max. Yeah. Nice. And that was more just because of the BS talk that was going on at the table, not so much the game. Yeah. So, yeah, that's me, Las Vegas, nice and simple.
Very nice. What you got, Def?
Well, this may come as a surprise, but I'm also going to talk about a very light, quick game.
That does come as a surprise. Now, you probably call, Nemesis light, knowing you or something.
Take this with a grain of salt because the designer is Vitalis Cerda and Julian Pombo. So this is, of course, Mercado de Lisboa, which before we started the podcast, I looked it up. I was certain somebody else has sealed it before. And it turns out, we haven't, which surprises me because the game has been out for about, well, it's been delivered from Kickstarter about 5 months now. So Mercado de Lisboa is the first small game by Vitalis Cerda and Julian Pombo, and it's spin-off from Vital's biggest games. This one's from Lisboa. And there's more games of this type coming down the road that will be like a small chunk out of the bigger games. They're meant to be quick, thinky fillers, is what Eagle Griffin calls them. So this game, all you do is you have the market of Lisbon, which is a simple 5x5 hex square, and you have restaurants and food stands, and around the market you have the slots for customers to come in and get food from the restaurants and stands. So on your turn, all you do is you have to decide whether you want to place a food stand in the market and pay some money for that, or whether you want to place a restaurant if you have the corresponding tile, or if you want to bring a customer in. And if you do the first or the last of these actions, then if the demand meets the supply, then you get some money. So if the customer that you place is looking for burgers, then your burger joints on that row or column will make money. It is extremely easy. It's, you know, very quick to play. There's no sort of deep strategy in it. It's a lot of fun, but it is surprisingly mean.
Oh.
So yes. I showed it to Steve a couple of weeks ago, and I think he enjoyed it. But what I like about this game is it gives you that sense of playing something that has enough meat on it to, you know, to scratch your brain a little bit, but it doesn't drag on. It doesn't get you tired. It's one of the few games that I have that you can go after you finish. You can go, oh, right, let's do another one of these. It's different enough, and I think it plays really well at two players. Given how tight it is, I haven't played it at more player counts, so I can't even imagine what it would be at three or four players. And
yeah, because the board state doesn't change for higher players, does it?
No.
Yeah.
So the game lasts probably 20 to 30 minutes. I don't think any of the games I've played go for more than 30 minutes. And it's a very basic, quick game that gives you enough to think about without overwhelming you with choices and those kinds of things. It's been a very good purchase for me, and I've enjoyed it with different people. I've played it with Timmy, I've played with my brother, now played it with Steve, and I'm sure I'll get to play it with other people as well. And apparently it has a very solid solo mode, which I haven't tried yet. I haven't had to. And yeah, that's Mercado de Lisboa. And what did you think, Steve?
I really liked it. I was surprised because I'm not the biggest Lacerda fan in the world. I played a few of the bigger games, and I've played one since then that I really enjoyed in Kanban. But so I didn't really know what to expect. I knew it was lighter, but it wasn't like I've been hanging to play it. So I was surprised because there's a lot of really cool decisions to make. Plays quite quick. I think the first game we played, we were like, you know, I think you might have been staying out of my way deliberately, but then in the second game, it was very much a case of, oh, well, if I go there, then that's going to help him there. And you had to really think about what your opponent's trying to do as well. So I really enjoy that. I'd love to play it at a higher play count because that decision space would just grow. You'd have to really strategize what you're going to do if you want something to still be good for you after three other people have had their turn. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I think at higher player counts, if anybody's played in the community, please let us know how it plays, because I've got this feeling that it's going to be, as you say, having bigger decision space, but at the same time, there's going to be less opportunities for players to really score, you know, multiple stands in a row or column, while as in a two-player game, you can easily get to a point where one row or column has three of your own stands and one of the other players or even none. So it becomes a no-brainer what you want to do there. But once you start having combinations of different players in a row or column, then they would probably take a step back and explain this. When you put a customer in, and if that customer wants, say, burgers, then all the stands in that row or column that sell burgers will get money, no matter which player they belong to. So it does become very, very interactive. And I think it is achieving what it was meant to achieve, to get people into these kinds of games where they're easy to get into, they have enough to keep you interested in scratching your head a bit, but they're fun, they're interactive, they're finishing up quickly. It's been a success, Mercado de Lisboa from Vital Lacerda and Julian Pombo, and published by Eagle Griffin Games.
All right. Now, guys, I've got a bit of a stat for you.
Okay. So, love me firstly, some stats.
Mike had Flick of Faith as his game, which on BGG is weighted at 1.25.
Mm-hmm.
I then did Las Vegas, which was weighted at 1.19. And coming in with the heaviest game of the day was Def with Mercado de Lisboa, which was weighted at 2.09. And I would argue that that might be the lightest game that Def has ever sizzled on the pod. However, if you add those three together, you get 4.54. And On Mars is a 4.64.
So what you're saying is we have to play all of them at once one day, try to play them all simultaneously, and that'll be the challenge.
Be slightly less hard than On Mars.
I like it.
Well, what else is? That's probably the quickest sizzle ever because they're all kind of short lighter games. And shorter games. Yeah, so there we go.
It probably aligns well with the topic of the day.
Absolutely. Though. Absolutely. Which is a great segue. But before we do that, we just need to do a quick shout out to Advent Games, who the competition has just finished for Aeon's End Legacy. So a big thank you to Advent Games for sponsoring us for the last month with the giveaway. And 2D6 Games have a new giveaway going up as soon as we do the announcement of the winner of Aeon's End Legacy. So we'll be more information on the next pod for what game that will be. But big shout out to both Advent and 2D6 for sponsoring the pod. As always, they're amazing folks and they do so much good for the hobby. So big thanks to them. But now that I've said that, it's kind of ruined Death's fantastic segue into our topic of the pod. Okay. So as mentioned at the top of the show, the topic of the pod is, what do we call it, Mike?
Board game flashbacks.
Yeah, that's right. So board game flashbacks, we're going to talk about some of the games we played when we joined the hobby, when we started on our little board game journey that has got us to this point now. What were the games that really spoke to us and got to the table a load when we first started? Just before we get started, guys, how did you sort of come up with the games that we're going to talk about today? Are you as mad as me and started doing BG stats really early on so you've got a decent picture, or are you just going off memory?
I had no idea what those sort of things were. I had no idea what the hobby was like when I first started. It was so new to me and crazy that I slowly started seeing what a beast this hobby was. I'm going from photos. So photos of my shelf. So I'm looking at this photo of a really proud shelf of mine. It's got four shelves of game on it. The bottom shelf is like a few Monopolies, chess, and Speak Out. And then the two middle shelves actually have board games. And the top shelf has a few books and like two, maybe three little games on there. So, and I was so happy with the shelf. I thought it was so cool. Look at this shelf. Now when you look at it, like, yeah, I've got a few more games now.
I remember my first shelf. I had to buy a new shelf because Ticket to Ride wouldn't fit in the hole. It wasn't until I'd bought Ticket to Ride that I went, this doesn't work.
Yeah.
So what about you, Def?
I only started recording stats in December 2019. So I don't have anything before that. But two observations. One, even stats from December 2019, which is less than 2 years ago, if I tell you the games on there, they will sound like a million years ago. Mm. And the second thing is I've noted down a few games from memory that I either used to play a lot younger or I actually played these games as some of my first modern board games a few years ago, but just never got really into it after that. But you could argue that these games were the gateway into the hobby, or made me at least familiar enough to feel comfortable trying more games in the recent times.
Mm. It's interesting with BG stats, right? Because the reason that I started so early is because I've talked about coming from the hobby from after my injury, where I used to play a lot of sport and used to train for triathlon and stuff. So I used to use Strava to track my rides and my runs and all that sort of stuff. So when I got into board games, it was almost my first thought was like, I need to track stuff because I've been tracking all that other stuff. I need to keep tracking. So I came onto it fairly early on for that reason. And I was showing Def earlier today some of the games that my first month of board gaming. I'll just read off a couple of them here because firstly, the biggest difference is that in the entire month, I logged six games.
Yeah,
I played six games today. So, number one on the list was Camel Up.
Oh wow!
And then I've got Catan, Ticket to Ride, Wits and Wages, and Travel Sequence.
Okay.
So, not just Sequence, but the Travel Edition of Sequence. So, of course. But then, like, I look at those games and Camel Up and Ticket to Ride and Wits and Wagers. So three of those five games, not only do I still have them, I will still happily play those games.
Mm.
Like they still, and it's not because there's nostalgia, it's just that they're still good games. They still stack up. And many people still love Catan. It wasn't for me, but many people love that. So it is interesting that even though my collection and my plays and all that have grown in those few years, those first few games are still great games that I'd still play today if I had the chance.
Yeah, I think that's similar to what I'm seeing here. That first month of BG Stats for me has Pandemic, Seven Wonders Duel, Azul, Catan, Dixit, Mysterium, Patchwork, Arboretum, you get the idea, right? So,
yeah.
And among all of these Mythic Battles Pantheon, which I have no idea how it got there, but so, I mean, most of these games I'd still happily play today, depending on the setting and all of that, and most of them still have. I've sold a couple of them, but not a great deal. But I think, you know, I wanted to sort of talk about a couple of older memories, which one of them is obviously Ticket to Ride, like most people, but also Scotland Yard, which I've spoken about before, but also Netrunner, the card game, which I believe it's been years now that it's been discontinued, but I have some really fond memories. And the funny thing is, I don't recall how the game played. I don't remember mechanics or what you actually did in the game, because it's been probably more than 20 years since I've played it. But I remember how it made me feel, you know. I remember that it was interesting and exciting, and the corporation versus the hacker, I believe, or I can't even remember a lot about it now. And that's the same feeling I get for some of these older games.
Mm.
For me, it was a lot of, like, interaction in games, I think, is one of the things that got me straight away. Like, I've spoken a few times about that one of my first games was Munchkin, because I'd purchased the Munchkin because it was themed in a cartoon series that I'm a fan of called Axe Cop. So I had this little Axe Cop pack of Munchkin, and I could never really figure out how it worked. And so I just had it sitting on my shelf for probably a year. Then I was dating someone who had a copy of Munchkin. I'm like, oh, can we learn that? Because I'd love to learn how to play my one. But my first actual purchase for a board game that I tried to research, I actually forgot that one of my first forays into board gaming was trying to find two-player board games, because it was my ex-girlfriend that introduced me to the hobby, and I was always looking forward to her friend coming over so we could play board games, because, like, oh, this is really cool, but we can never play just the two of us, because she kept telling me that a lot of these games you had to have at least three or four people. So I started, all right, well, I need to buy a board game. I need to buy a board game that we can play for two people, and I was researching two-player board games. My first proper board game purchase and first game that I learned properly to play was Battle Lore Second Edition.
You're so right.
1v1, just, you know, like, now I was thinking back to it, because someone asked me to play it recently, and I'm like, I can't remember how to play. But I'm like, oh, there's drafting in that. Like, you have to draft your sort of people you're using in your army at the start, and then you're actually doing, you know, hex-based battles and trying to do a bit of area control. I'm like, oh, that was actually an interesting sort of foray into gaming. And I played the hell out of that when I got that. I was teaching anyone that would give me a second to show them the game. So, like, Munchkin and Battlelore were my very first two. It's very different, but games to sort of get me into the hobby.
Interesting story that I've got is one of the games that I have very strong memories of it, and this is going to come across really weird, is Catan the Dice Game.
Okay. Mm.
And the reason for that is when we were younger, some of these games were the only ones that we were exposed to. So Catan, Ticket to Ride, Carcassonne, Alhambra was the other one that we used to play many years ago. And I remember we had a couple of holidays with Dimi, and I very vividly remember us saying, what are we going to take with us? And Catan the Dice Game was the main thing that we were worried not to forget, because we'd sit in the evenings at a, you know, balcony or somewhere outside, and this is a tiny box, right? Has like a few dice, six dice, if I remember correctly, and you roll the dice and you just write down on your notebook what you know resources you get, and you go and play Catan based on the dice results. And you know what I'm trying to say here is that it doesn't take great mechanics or something that is outdated by any standards of modern board games. Doesn't have a huge production. It's not a big game. It does not take 3 hours to play. It can still give you great moments and great memories. So I think there's games for every setting, and every game has its place in the hobby. But it is quite interesting how these create memories. And I don't really remember, again, how to play that game. I remember you roll a bunch of dice, and it's Catan. How difficult can it be?
But
I remember that I had a great time playing it.
I've just been thinking, because Ticket to Ride, although I attribute it to being my gateway into the hobby, it wasn't the physical game. It was actually the PlayStation version.
So really?
PlayStation had a version where it would be on the front TV, and then everyone would get their device, and you'd play your board, like your turn, on your own iPad or iPhone or whatever else, and then it would show the full board on the main screen.
Okay.
And we started playing that as a family just for something different. And that was kind of what got the juices flowing. It was like, okay, this is like, because I used to, if I go a step further back, we used to play a lot of Phase 10. And Phase 10 is basically a rummy style game. And Ticket to Ride is a rummy style game. So that was the link. And that kind of dug a hole for Phase 10 and buried it, and has never been seen again ever since, because I could see all the problems with Phase 10 as soon as I saw Ticket to Ride. But up until that point, I used to love Phase 10. I think it was great, but I'd never experienced how a refined version of that would be, because if you wanted to play Phase 10 from beginning to end, you'd have to take about 4 hours out of your day to get lucky with some cards. Like, I look back on that and I think, how did I find that entertaining for that many hours? But as soon as you see that modern style, that refinement in the games, you're like, this is great. And, you know, I've talked about, you know, Risk before. Risk was always the game I had on high on this pedestal as the game that I love to play. And even when I started looking at modern board games, I did it with the guise of, well, my wife doesn't like to play Risk, so I need to find games that we would like to play together. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to find a game as good as Risk, but I'll find something okay, you know. I don't talk about Risk anymore, and you move on, because like you say, Def, there's the refinement and the mechanics that we have in the games today are just it's brilliant. But even back, like, you know, when you look at Catan and you look at Ticket to Ride and Pandemic, Splendor, and all those, you know, those known gateway games, they are so different to non-modern games. Like, they're so much better. There's such a better ease into the hobby than anything that's ever come before it in my house.
On that note, I've got a confession to make. I've never played Risk.
Wow.
Okay. Never.
I would have. To be honest, Mike, that doesn't surprise me for you, but it does surprise me with Death.
Yeah.
Just think of it as an area control game based purely on the luck of die rolls and getting reinforcements randomly throughout the game at ascending numbers. So if you time it well, so you win the game.
Pandemic the war game.
Except it's competitive, yeah.
A couple of games that I thought I'd mention, aside from the ones that we already spoke about, and it just occurred to me that they're actually essentially the same game, but a Risk, in which I hadn't realized up until right now. I was looking them up on Board Game Geek, and they're actually by the same designer, Rainer Knizia. That is Lost Cities, which is a very simple sort of expedition game where all you're doing, you have cards with numbers, that's all they have, and colors. I reckon, Mike, you would love this game if you haven't played Lost Cities.
No, I haven't.
It's a two-player game, and all you do is you're trying to create these expeditions in five different, or maybe six, I can't remember now, colors. But you have to play, every card you play has to be larger than the previous number.
Okay.
But if you don't reach a certain minimum, that you get negative points for that. So you don't really know. And there's only one copy of each card in the entire deck. So you don't know what your opponent has drawn, and you kind of start doubling up on some expeditions and stuff. It's a very, very simple game, quick, fun, you know, 25 years old. And then The second game I was going to mention, because it's still sitting back home in Greece, we didn't take that with us when we moved, is Keltis. And I just realized it's by the same designer, and it's actually a reskin of Lost Cities.
That's brilliant.
You can play it with more players, where you play a bunch of cards and go up on some tracks with your stones. And I just, again, same kind of thing. I have so many fond memories of playing those games. And it's not a matter of time or era, you know. I am 100% confident that people that get into the hobby now, or maybe not even in the hobby, if they play these games, they will have a great time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the whole point there was that these games still have their place, and it's interesting to dive into some of these memories.
I'm having flashbacks at the moment, because I'm looking at my little collection that I have in front of me on this little photo. And as I look through a lot of the games, it's a flashback to like my first couple of visits to my first ever board game group. Because like I said, I went in there very dry. I only had played a couple of board games before. But every time I went there, nearly every game that I played, I went and purchased. Because I'm like, this is amazing. This is a game. And like, I always talk about how I don't only like Euros. I don't only like party games. I don't only like roll. I like everything. That's why my collection's so huge, because I want a taste of everything, because I love every kind of game. And looking through to see the first couple games that I purchased that I got exposed to, I think the first time that I went and I purchased right after were Dixit and When I Dream. You know, this abstract card game where you're just, you know, you're not necessarily, you're looking at a card and making up clues about what this card is and just trying to interpret things. And I found that so interesting, you know. And When I Dream, this sort of social deduction game where you're blindfolded and people yelling words at you and such a big group can play. And these things just spoke to me so well. And I think the next time I went, I played Meeple Circus, a dexterity game. It's stacking. It's not Jenga. It's way harder than Jenga. It actually has strategy to it and skill, and blew my absolute mind. And my first ever Euro that I purchased is here, which I'm very sad because I keep forgetting about. It's one of my old housemates' favorite ever games, and I've only played it the once, and I'm dying to get to the table again. It's Colosseum. Have you guys ever played Colosseum?
No.
I haven't.
It's fantastic. And from over there's auctioning in there, and I can barely even remember. I just remember that I went to my first ever board game like event. It was called like Games in the Meadows or something. It was down here in Melbourne. And I guess I'm gonna teach you this game, Colosseum. It's like my favorite game ever. And it intimidated the hell out of me because it's a big board and lots of pieces, but had such a good time. I want to play that again, man. I feel an oath coming up, because I bought that straight away after he taught me that, and that was my first ever Euro purchase, and I've never played it since. And yeah, that's bringing back some. It's interesting, you know. Like doing this, I was worried I was going to be spitting about a lot of things I've spoken about before, but looking at these at this photo, and it's just memories. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like they're memories, and that's why that game's never left my collection, because I'm a hoarder, but also because, you know, that memory of my first ever Euro play, and then seeking out that game and finding a copy and being like, oh, I got that game too, and you know, just the memories of my first ever board game group helping opening up my eyes to this amazing hobby and all the different tastes. It was like it's like a smorgasbord, you know. Like I want to have a bit of this and a bit of that, and that's what I see here. I see my introduction to gaming that's grown to what's behind me today, you know, and it's pretty cool to look at.
Yeah, I've got two picks up. I've got a pick of my first 5x5 Kallax, and I mentioned off the air of a few of the games that I like. There's 25 spots in a 5x5 Kallax, and I didn't have enough games to fill anywhere near that. So 16 of the 25 spaces are taken up by one game on display. So to put that in perspective, that same 5x5 Kallax is absolutely bursting at the seams currently, and so is its neighboring Kallax and the other neighboring Kallax. So things have changed. But what hasn't changed is some of those games. And some of the little ones are more surprising to the fact that they were in my collection that long ago, like Sushi Go Party, you know, Onirim, the solo card game. I didn't realize I'd had that game for so long. But the one that sticks out to me, which is a funny story, which is Lords of Waterdeep.
Oh, yeah?
Because I distinctly remember buying this game, and it was kind of like when I was a teenager, I was into – I liked louder music, but it felt weird to like music like that. So I remember going to the Vibes record store in Casino and just feeling awkward about buying a Tool album because I was like 13 and I shouldn't like Tool, you know, and I just felt weird. And that's how I felt when I bought Lords of Waterdeep because I was in Cairns for work and I went to this board game shop, a brilliant board game shop, by the way, called The Wicked Goblin. If you're ever in Cairns, check it out. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at all these games and I just started watching The Dice Tower and Shut Up and Sit Down and a few other things. And I'm looking at Rising Sun, I'm looking at Lords of Waterdeep and some other games. And I've said to the guy, I'm fairly new to the hobby, but I'm loving it. And these are the games I've got. And he's like, you should play Lords of Waterdeep. And I went, oh, Dungeons and Dragons. I don't know if I want to dive into Dungeons and Dragons. Like that's another step. I don't know if I'm ready for that. And he's like, oh, no, don't worry about the Dungeons and Dragons theme. It's fine. I'm like, oh, I don't know. And I looked at it. And it was like half the price of Rising Sun. So I'm like, all right, I'll buy it. And I went back to my motel room and I sat up and I learned how to play it on the coffee table. And it was about halfway through the game, I just went, well, this is my favorite game of all time. I'd only played it for half a game and playing multi-handed so I could understand the rules in a multiplayer game. And it was just like, but I was so apprehensive about buying that game. That was, and I'm just looking at it on my shelf in that picture. And it's still on my shelf in that over there. So.
Yeah, I think you mentioned before, Mike, about the memories. And I think it's one of the things that with the board game hobby, you can count on to create memories for you because all the games that I've mentioned before, it's not that I don't really remember how half of these games play even. Mm. Keltis, I have no idea. I'd have to learn this from scratch. You know, I don't remember. But I do remember who I played it with. I remember the setting. I remember, you know, the people around it.
Mm.
So, and hence, you remember how you felt playing that. So, and I think that's, you know, indicative of how powerful the whole situation with, you know, playing board games and having people to play them with is. It creates memories for you. And I don't know. I
was going to say, even the memory of like, I'm looking at this box of Colosseum again, and that's my first ever game with metal coins. And I'm like, oh my god, this thing has metal coins. Like, look how heavy this bag is of coins, and the excitement behind it, and little things like that. Like, I don't know why this is actually just getting me all giddy thinking about this game, and it's funny. Like, I remember reading the book, and I could notice things were wrong, and that was one of my first ever experience with Board Game Geek, because I was looking up because there was. I was trying to count all the pieces and there was something wrong and there was two bits of information in the rule book that would give me opposite like bits of information. I'm like, something's wrong here. I need to Google and find out what's going on. And in Board Game Geek, I found in the file section, someone had printable corrections that you could cut out and glue over the book because they did a bunch of misprints. It was one of the first prints of the game. And so I remember that, you know, finding this website, had to sign up to it because you can't get to the file section without logging in. And then I was printing out these files of, you know, cutting out and gluing these bits of information into the rule book because I wanted to have the rule book correct. I didn't want to reprint the whole rule book. And I was appalled I couldn't download the whole thing. You know, like it was interesting. That was my first foray into Board Game Geek was because of that game.
Well, I just found a photo from my shelves dated November 2019, which, again, it's not even 2 years ago, but the games are Rivals for Catan, Jaipur, Seven Wonders Duel, Exploding Kittens, Onitama, Fox in the Forest, Lost Cities, Patchwork, King Domino, Gravity Superstars, and a couple of other things. I see Dixit still in shrink.
It's all right if it's not still in shrink, though.
But at the bottom, at the very bottom of the shelf, I see the first signs of madness because I can see clearly Gloomhaven and Through the Ages staring at me. So
that is interesting because that 5x5 Kallax of mine, There's no Scythe. There's no Terraforming Mars. There's no Gloomhaven. They're clear. Like, the Euroest game there is probably Dominion, maybe. But then that was 6 months later is my first top nine on PubMeeple that I did. And obviously things changed in that 6 months because that top nine is Scythe, Terraforming Mars, Pandemic Legacy, Lords of Waterdeep, still there, number four. Yeah. Viticulture, Dominion, Ticket to Ride Europe, Chronicles of Crime, and Deception Murder in Hong Kong.
That's awesome.
So that's in 6 months how much that's changed, but then how much that has stayed the same since then.
Mm.
Like all of those games were in my top 100 when we did the top 100 this year.
Do you think there's more of these types of games being released now, like more entry-level gateway types of games, or is it, you know, we get more variety in the more complex, more involved, more... Both.
I'd say both. Like they're bringing out a lot of games that are still great to teach new people, you know? I think the harder part is that it's the gamer gamers that find them. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I don't know, Skull is great for new people, but you don't see a lot of new people going and buying Skull. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like Illusion, Six Nymphed. Like if I saw Six Nymphed on a shelf, I would never buy that. It sounds like I'm not going to understand it. Yep. What the hell is Six Nymphed? You know, like things like that. But you ask a gamer what Six Nymphed is, like, oh yeah, I know what that is. You know, Hanabi. Mm. Like I've been teaching my family a bunch of really simple games. I'm like, you'd never find these. You might find things like Baron Park. You might find things like Dominion. There's still a lot of entry, you know, Catan and Ticket to Ride, because if you look up, you know, gateway, like, you know, game, you know, I'm new to board games, what should I buy? Those are things going to come up first because they're the mass produced. They're the ones that come up with a million iterations of them. They're the ones that, you know, 100 people are going to recommend to this person. But there's little niche games that, you know, the three games that we spoke about at the start of our episode today, you know?
Yeah.
Not one of them you'll find someone will pick up because, A, Las Vegas is out of print now, you know? Lisboa?
Mercado Lisboa.
That one's not going to be, you know, it's a Lacerda game. It's probably not in every single shop. It's, you know, once again, it's not Baron Park. It's not Animals and Cute, you know. It's a party version game of a Euro game, you know what I mean? It doesn't, to me, that wouldn't have looked appealing to me at all, you know what I mean? When I first started, it would look right past it, you know. Then you got, you know, Flick of Faith. The name of the game isn't even on the front of the box. It's just a bunch of gods sitting around a round table, you know. It's quirky and different. But all those games, us gamer games, we'll play them happily together. We'll play them happily with new people, but people new to the hobby trying to work on it by themselves, they'll never find it.
Well, it's a success by saturation, right? Because you can suggest to someone that Ticket to Ride, they should play Ticket to Ride, and you will know that they'll be able to buy that the next time they're at the shops.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Because it'll be in seven different stores, and you might not even have to say, go and get it, but they might go, oh, that's that game that Steve mentioned last week.
Yeah.
I might grab that off the shelf. That's the same for Ticket to Ride, for Catan, for Carcassonne, and probably not many more. Like, what are some other games that fall into that category that you
get? Dominion?
Yeah, but I don't know whether you see Dominion on the shop shelves like you do Catan and Ticket to Ride.
Codenames
is another great one. Yeah. Pandemic, obviously.
Pandemic.
Yeah. So it's like while there are all these other great alternatives, and you're right, if I had someone move in with me today and never played board games, their gateway games probably wouldn't be those games.
Yeah.
At least I know that if I have someone visit and they're like, oh, I'm looking at getting into board games, I know that I can suggest that and they don't have to go digging to the edges of the earth to find it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to just back this Kickstarter that's on now will be fulfilling in 2.5 years and costs $600.
Stop reading my mind, Def.
It's interesting. Like, Def, did you – here's a question for you guys, because you guys played a lot of those early games. Steve went to a board game shop and asked a question. Def, how did you, like, start learning about the games yourself? Did you have somebody hold your hand and lead you into the hobby, or were you, like, researching it yourself?
No, it's a strange story because in Greece, where I grew up, the board games and in general the hobbies were considered very geeky, very niche, very, you know, it was something that did not actually grow until much, much later than in Australia or the United States.
Yeah.
So, but there was one single shop that started translating board games from English, which was a prerequisite if you were to sell them in Greece. And I accidentally walked into it because when I was little, my dad used to work in downtown Athens in the Bank of Greece. And some days he would take me with him the entire day because there was a coin shop. And it was this strip of coin shops and train model shops, you know, those old traditional, you know, smoky shops where you go in and because you can't actually see anything from the windows. They're like all fogged and, you know, they've been there for 300 years. And so accidentally thought this new place was another train model shop. I just walked in to have a look at the trains. And they had these weird boxes with, you know, board games that were translated from English. And that's how I got into it, because these guys started with community first. So they would gather people every Saturday and show them these weird new games. And that's how I kind of started learning about them and then went on my own.
And then you started researching yourself. Because that's what I'd be interested to hear from our listeners, okay? So someone like Def started researching himself because he found an interest, and he started with your Catan, your Ticket to Ride, and your Carcassonne. Whereas I still haven't played Catan. I played Ticket to Ride a year and a half into the hobby, Carcassonne probably around the same time. But my first proper foray into the hobby was going to a board game group. And that's why my first games were not typical gateway games. They were your sort of different games that not everyone will generally know. So I'd be interested to see from other people if you researched the hobby yourself because you were interested, did you all sort of start with your Ticket to Ride, your Carcassonne, your very typical gateway games? Or if you sort of had someone lead you into it, did you also skip a lot of those until later on the hobby? I think that'd be interesting sort of to peek through both of those windows and see if there's a common theme between those.
Yeah, I think that's a good discussion, Mike, because board game groups are a thing now. When we started playing games, there was no such thing.
Exactly.
Nobody, like I was the one playing board games, even those little ones or very, you know, in between other hobbies, not as dominant in your life. While now I think you would have lots and lots of people that would get into board games through groups. I mean, we're a very good example of that as a board game barbecue community, where, you know, we introduce people to the hobby and to certain, you know, levels or categories of games they would never thought they'd get into. Hell, we do that ourselves to ourselves.
100%. I think the big thing that the reason this I've really enjoyed this conversation, mind you, because it's really brought back some great memories. But that's, I guess, the big thing that it's done is it's shone a light on the fact that all these games that we may not play as often these days, they're all stellar games. Like a lot of these games, I'd happily play, even though some of the ones that you guys mentioned that I hadn't played. I'm keen to check out Lost Cities. I still haven't played Lost Cities.
Oh yeah, I will bring it.
And I guess that comes back to us being addicts, not experts, because you would expect that a board game podcast, that the people on those podcasts would have played all of those seminal games that, you know, the Lost Cities and the Catans and all that. But that's not what we're about. We're a fairly fresh group, and we talk about the things that we love playing right now. And I think it's awesome. Like I'm changing what's on my oath because of this segment.
I'm going to change my oath as well. Yeah. I was thinking the same thing. And as you were talking, I was scrolling through some of my photos, and bless Google Photos, because you can type shelves on the search bar. It will bring you all of the shelving photos. So I found this photo, which is 11 months later than the photo I was describing before, right?
Yep.
And in the foreground, I've got the Anachrony Infinity box. And in the background, you can still see Sequence, Pandemic, Century, and Ticket to Ride, the card game. Yeah. So this is a very representative photo of what we've been discussing, right?
Absolutely. I love that they're still there, though.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Yeah. All right, well...
Can I ask one question? We're talking about flashbacks, and I know we generally try to keep things positive, but not saying anything's a bad game, but do you remember the first game that you would, oh, no, this might not be for me. Do you guys remember, for me, I think the first game that I was like, oh, was Magic Maze because I couldn't talk. And try to stop me talking and having someone bang that piece at you that you need to do something and you can't figure it out. It was so anxiety inducing. And I was like, I don't want to play that again. And I have played it again, and it is a great game now that I know what to sort of expect. I'll still joke around saying I don't like it, but that's just because, you know, I want to talk. But that was my first experience. Like, whoa, that was weird. What happened there? Do you guys remember one of the first games that made you halt and go, whoa, what's this?
Lost Ruins of Arnak. Sorry, I'm joking.
Oh, it's hard. Like, even modern, if you call it modern gaming, because the one that sticks in my mind is Cards Against Humanity, which is a bit of a cliche answer, right?
Okay.
Sure.
But I remember playing that at a party before I was in the hobby, and I was like, oh, it's a bit of fun, haha. And then so when I got into the hobby, I'm like, yeah, I should buy a game of that because that was a bit of fun. And then when I played it the next time, I'm like, oh, I get it. It's not really that fun. It's just a couple of cards and you know this sounds like the best answer. And what did it for me in that game was I might have even mentioned this in the podcast before, I had the perfect answer to a question and it didn't win. And it's not that I'm upset about not winning, it's just that it was literally, and it wasn't funny, it was actually sad, but it was that's right, blank died, how question mark blank. And I'm kid you not, the two cards I had in my hand were Steve Irwin and a stingray barb to the chest. So, like, those three cards are made to work together, right? That's right. Steve Irwin died, how stingray barb to the chest.
Yeah.
And I lost because someone said that something pooped in a laptop. And I'm like, ah, it's one of these games. And that was it for me. I was done. And unfortunately, at that point, I'd already backed a game called Charty Party on Kickstarter, which is essentially Cards Against Humanity with graphs.
Yeah.
And that was was my first Kickstarter regret.
Yeah.
So,
interesting.
I can't remember a specific board game I had this reaction with, but I remember something close enough. I don't know if this is allowed, but it was Dungeons and Dragons. So okay. Growing up again in Greece in the 1980s or early 1990s, it was this almost cult thing.
Mm.
Also, it was like connected to, you know, things that were very unconventional in a very conservative religious country. Mm. And so it was, you know, very iffy or walking on eggshells. It was taboo, exactly. So when somebody asked me, hey, do you want to play Dungeons and Dragons? I was like, I don't really want to get into that stuff. And then, you know, you kind of grow out of that phase, or your brain starts operating normally. And I was, you know, doing DM and all sorts of stuff, or Forgotten Realms and whatever else, other worlds that were existed. But that was, I remember that very vividly, that it was seen from society as something, you know, not good, not well to get yourself into, which was quite interesting.
I do remember when I was at school, there was definitely, there was two ways you could go, three ways you could go. You could play 500, you could play poker, or you could play D&D.
Mm-hmm.
And I went the 500 route, and I always thought the other two routes were mental.
Yeah.
You know. And then as I got older, I started playing poker, and then as I've only recently got old enough to go, you know what, I really wish I played D&D. I really wish I chose D&D all those years ago. Well, this is definitely, like Mike said, this is definitely a topic that we want your input on. This would be great to just hopefully do the same as it's done for us. It's really refreshed us and given us a bit of perspective on where we've come from and whatnot. So definitely share your information in the comments of this episode. We'd love to keep the conversation going for this one. But with that, we'll finish up the topic of the pod and head into the bracket battle. Okay, bracket battle, as usual, brought to you by Game Toppers, those lovely Game Topper table toppers that you can put on and play board games on a lovely surface. We had one at the game day last week, and it's always a pleasure to play, even though I didn't get a chance this time around because it was packed. Everyone wanted to be at that table all day. We thank you very much for your support, but now on to the good stuff. So, Mike, how do you think this one went, Kling vs. Baron Park?
I'm going to be sad either way. Like, I had to decide which one I was going to vote for, and I ended up voting for Clank. Just because I feel with the expansions, a lot more in there. And I think Baron Park, I've got another game now that scratches that itch a bit better for me as well these days. But it's still a great introduction game. But Clank for me is where I put my vote. I don't know which way it'll go, though. I think both games are quite loved by people. And I haven't kept it. I wanted to be surprised for this. So I haven't kept my eye on it.
Any thoughts, Steph?
Not really. I mean, I don't even follow the votes during battles I'm involved in because I actually enjoy listening the results through the podcast. So I have no idea how this would have went. Based on my understanding of the popularity of these games, I think Clank would have got it, but...
Well, I can tell you that the winner won in all four areas, but didn't win by more than 10 in any area.
Mm. I was hoping it would be close, like not too harsh, yeah.
Yeah. And that game was Clank. Clank gets through. Baron Park is left behind.
Sorry, Baron Park. Sorry, Phil.
We're trying really hard, Phil. We got a few games of his in the list. But I don't know if any got through to round two. I know Archaeology suffered a terrible defeat.
Rubbed.
All right, but if we've just resolved a battle, it means we've got to start a new one. And to help us with this, we've invited another person onto the podcast. Welcome, Jules.
Hey, guys. How are we doing?
Very well, thanks. Thanks for coming along. Now, Jules, you are here because the round one of the board game bracket could be also described as the Def versus Jules Chronicles.
Yeah, pretty much.
You guys have had a lot of games against each other, and this is the last one of that lot. So this is Gaia Project versus Castell. So, Jules, you're here to fly the flag for Castell, so I'm going to let you go first and tell everybody why Castell is better than Gaia Project.
All right. So, Castell is such a special game to me. There is nothing else like it on the market. There is no other game that takes such a special cultural activity in Barcelona and turns it into a magnificent game. For those that still don't know what Castell's about, you're trying to recruit a team of people to build human towers and go and compete in different festivals and put on local performances to build the biggest towers or put on special acts that the people want to see, feats of strength or feats of balance. It's such a crunchy puzzle that I find a delight to play every single time. The artwork is gorgeous. They look like hand-drawn sort of people and they're different sizes, the ones that you recruit. And the artwork is so tied into the theme well that even the little person you put on top has the arm raise, which is actually a part of the real sport. It's just so well done. It's so charming. I've taught this game to many people and they've all fell in love with it. I don't know why it doesn't have the praise that it does, but it is something special. And for all those reasons I've listed, it is better than Gaia Project. Space is overdone. It was designed in paint. It is just... it's not interesting. If space games are a dime a dozen, and the artwork, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to question Castell looks prettier than Gaia Project, but to me, Castell, of course, gets my vote. I put it in, but man, I think if I set them up on a table, a lot more people would be having a look at Castell than they would Gaia Project.
Interesting. Wow. I don't know how Def's going to feel. Actually, yes, I do. Def, tell us why Jules is wrong.
Well, sorry, I didn't realize you. I actually needed to speak to this. It's a good thing that we're not comparing prettiness or what was it you called it? It's pretty, yes. It's a good thing we're not comparing that, but we're instead of comparing how good a board game is. But Castell is a good game. I'm one of those people that bought it after we played it together. And I think we both have played it with Steve and separately as well. I definitely played it with Steve two-player and we've played it three-player. And it's a good game. But Gaia Project is Gaia Project. It's I think it's obviously one of my favorite games, and you'd probably have to listen to the upcoming countdown that we've got to see where it landed. But it's just a phenomenal design for me. It has infinite amount of replayability and variability. It does a few things in a way that is, I think, set standard for the business, for the industry, for the market, for the hobby, in terms of variable player powers, in terms of efficiency, how you play it, how interesting it is to learn it. It's just a phenomenal game. So my vote will go that way.
Well,
now Steve's now going to tell me I'm not selling it well again.
Well, it's just like, I'm just thinking, because I know that Jules, you still haven't played Gaia Project, right?
I have not. And honestly, like, the thing that has stopped me is that artwork. It just doesn't look interesting.
It's interesting because I'd never, like, until you pointed out the artwork, I'd never even considered it to be that bad. And I think maybe this is just a space thing with me, because I never thought Terraforming Mars was terribly bad.
Yeah.
But now when someone brings it up, you're like, oh, I could see where there could be improvements. But I do think Gaia Project looks better than Terraforming Mars.
Sure.
That's another battle altogether. but these two games made my top 100 in spaces 39 and 45, so very close to each other. But I will also give the nod slightly to Gaia Project. I do love both games, but I think Gaia Project offers a bit more as far as a longevity is concerned than Castell might. What about you, Mike? Have you played either of these?
I have not played either of these. Not yet, no. They both sound interesting to me. The whole concept of stacking people on top of each other being the theme of a game, I like that idea because it's so different to the norm. But then variable player powers and the monster that guy is interests me as well. So I don't have a dog in the fight. So I probably won't chuck a vote in this one because I got no idea. But I'd happily try both games.
All right. Well, Jules, is there any last parting piece that you want to say on Castell's defense?
I mean, look, it's no secret Castell is not as widely known as Gaia Project. So if anyone wants to learn this game, there is a TTS mod available. Just reach out to me on Discord and I'll happily teach it. It's a delightful game. It's really, really well done.
Yeah. The good thing about Castell is ever since I played it, I can always say it is my number one game about human stacking.
Absolutely.
So, not even a contest. All right, but it isn't up to us four. It is up to you fantastic people who listen to our podcast and engage in our community. So if you would like to vote on this, just head to our Facebook community page, our Instagram, or on our Discord and the Bracket Battle channel. Things are falling apart everywhere. Have your say. This one will take a week to get to a result, and we're getting very close to round two of the Bracket Battle. It's probably going to be upon us before the end of the year, so cast your votes, and let's see who this comes up against in round two. Big thanks to Jules for popping in for the Bracket Battle, mate.
No worries. That was good, guys. Thanks.
See you, bud.
See you, man.
Cheers. So now that we've finished the Bracket Battle, we will move on to swearing an oath. Okay, so look, swear an oath. I haven't done my oaths. I've got two of them. I'm letting the team down.
Slack, Steve.
I'm not on this coming Wednesday, though, so I've got a week between now and then, so I should definitely be able to resolve the fact that I haven't played Starscrappers Orbital or Radlands. In fact, Def, I want you to help me with Radlands, mate.
Radlands?
Yeah.
Sold.
Done. That was easy. Now, you can also help me with the other one too, Starscrappers Orbital, if you like. Jacob Frixilius, guy who made Terraforming Mars, we'll give that a crack too.
Yeah, I remember that, seeing that. Didn't buy it, but definitely something I'd be keen to try out.
The artwork looks about as good as Terraforming Mars, just quietly.
It does, but does it really matter, right? If Terraforming Mars has taught us one thing is, if the game is great, the art is not going to get in the way.
That's right. But I am going to add an oath, and after our conversations earlier in this episode, I thought that I've changed what my oath is going to be, and I am going to get back out to the table a cracking game of Ticket to Ride with my family over the next week. At some point, I'm going to get it all out. We're all going to go back to square one where it all started.
Love
it. I, Stephen Shiver, swear to play the previous two O's and Ticket to Ride before I'm on the next podcast.
I like it.
How about you, Mike?
I've added to my oaths. So I think I'm going to do two oaths, but one of them I'm going to make an ongoing one because I don't know how quick I can get it done. So the one I originally had was I've bought a bunch of games lately and I should probably start playing them. So one of the games that I'm quite interested to play because it's another one that mixes two things in a that I haven't seen mixed before is Sonora. I really want to play Sonora, which is a flick and write. So it's a dexterity and a write game, like, you know, not a roll and write, a flick and write. Something a bit different. And I like that it, you have to, I don't really know how it works. I watched a video about ages ago, but you're actually playing four mini games. There's like four mini roll and write games on the one sheet, and you're using this place that you flick the, your little discs onto to fill in those four sheets. And I think it's up to you if you want to concentrate heavily on one or spread out amongst four of them. It just looks so different. And with my recent love for roll and writes and flip and writes, why not try a flick and write? So I, Michael Faruja, will promise to play and swear an oath to play Sonora by the time on the podcast next. The other one I'm not going to swear to do by the next time on the podcast. But in light of our conversation today, I'm going to play. So looking at that photo from those games that I bought a couple of years ago, there are two games there that I've never played. And I've still got in my collection today. Okay. And both of them could probably leave my collection, might be fine, but I want to just do them a justice and just give them a try at some point. One of them might be harder than the other. So the one that I can play, it's a two-player dungeon crawler, which is one versus one, and it's called Gob's Heroes, I think it is. It was like a little French game with minis that I've never seen anywhere else before. I picked it up on a whim, and it's my first ever attempt at painting. So there's some very badly painted minis in there. but it's like, yeah, I think you have to like draft which people you're drafting onto your team and then fight head to head until one of you are the only one left on the board. So I want to play that. I would like to play – this is one that might be a bit harder, but I think I know who I can ask to play it. I was really excited. After loving Munchkin, I got a copy of Munchkin Quest, which is like a dungeon crawler version of Munchkin. So I'd like to try to get that to the table eventually. And my third one in this little long-term oath that I want to do, I want to play Colosseum again. Like, just looking at that box over and over, it's so heavy, and I just remember it being such a great game. I just want to see how it lives up to the memory, because that was like my first ever Euro-style game without a whole heap of theme, but I just remember having such a good time with it. So I'm Michael Faruja, will swear to play Colosseum, Munchkin Quest, and Gob's Heroes by some point in the near future, and I will report back if and when I do play those games, but that'll be an ongoing one.
Tell me, did you have an oath that you had to fulfill?
Oh, sorry. Coming yes, up. Yes. I should also report back. Sorry. I swore an oath to play Dinosaur World, and I did keep that oath. I did enjoy it. It makes me really want to play Dinosaur Island again because I want to compare the two. I want to compare the two because even though Dinosaur Island still is quite high on my top 100, it still has got a decent high spot. I haven't played it in a very long time. But I do miss that whole pulling your meeples out of a bag and putting them in the park. There's a few things that I miss about that game that, like, Dinosaur World, I see, like, being a much more strategic version. But in my brain, Dinosaur Island, I think, is a more fun version from memory. So I want to play it again so I can compare them directly close together. But I really want to compare it. But I did enjoy Dinosaur World. I felt like I wished I'd built more. I don't know. Like, I felt like I didn't build enough, but it was very strategic. We're going to place things and we're going to take your tour. I did quite like it. I played it two players, which I also don't feel is probably playing it at its best. I like to also play that at a higher play count and get the proper feel for it. But I did enjoy myself. So Dinosaur World was a success, and I've already explained my oaths.
Nice one. That is some commitment you have made there, Mike.
Well, that's only fantastic. One, but Sonora by the time on the podcast next. And the other ones are going to be like an ongoing one in the background. I want to play these games I've had in my collection for such a long time and I've never given a chance and revisit Colosseum. I feel like I need a bit of a push to get them done.
All right, which just leaves us with Death, mate. How have you gone with your oath?
next question. I still haven't achieved it. The oath was to play Zia Legends of the Drift system with you, Steve, and we still haven't done that. So I drag me into yours, I'll drag you into mine. But yeah, doing that discussion, having that discussion earlier about, you know, a few of the first games also made me want to change what I want to swear today. And I think I will get, next time we meet, I will get Lost Cities across so you can try.
Cool.
And if any of the other games of that time, you know, you haven't played, I'd be keen to have a go at them again. So, yeah, Zia, Legends of the Drift System and Lost Cities would have to make an interesting combination of a game night, I reckon.
Yeah, that sounds like we need to set aside a day, just play four games, knock out all of our oaths.
That's right.
Maybe five and finish with Ticket to Ride. We'll see. Oh, that's awesome. Well, that will bring us, that's the end of the O's, which means it's the end of the show. Once again, just a quick shout out to both Advent Games and 2D6 for all the wonderful support that they give us here on the podcast. And we will catch you on the next one. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Steve-O. Thanks, Steph.
And thanks, Steph. Yep.
Thank you, guys. It was good. Really enjoyed it.
Catch you on 153. Cheers.
See ya.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Board Game Barbecue Podcast. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Discord, or YouTube, and you can find all of those links in the show notes of this podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and here's hoping your next game is a sizzling one.